listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow, Episode 3, Exile. Think Liechtenstein. Better, Poland between the two world wars. Maybe Czechoslovakia. Mongolia. Finland will do too. A relatively small, weak political entity, located more or less between two large hostile empires. An entity whose hope for independent survival depends on the ability of its leaders to delicately negotiate between two larger powers. A political entity that undoubtedly sees itself as a continuation and bearer of a long and storied history, but which is seen by most others as a mere pawn in a larger geopolitical struggle. Now that that image is in mind, think of Judah in the 7th and 6th centuries BCE. In the last episode, I discussed the religion of ancient Israel. In this episode, I turn to the history of the last years of the independent kingdom of Judah. At the end of the last episode, I claimed that the movement from Israelite religion to, well, I guess we can call it Judaism, really got going with the fall of Judah, which was in turn a consequence of a series of political blunders. The Judahites, of course, did not quite see it that way, and here I will discuss in more detail the last few decades of the kingdom, how we might understand the fall of Judah, and how the Judahites themselves saw this monumentous event. Our main source is the Bible itself, particularly the last few chapters of the books of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. These sources provide a fascinating glimpse of both the history of Judah and its historiography, that is, how they told their own story. First, a word of caution. Like many monarchical histories, the history of the last decades of Judahite rule is peppered with names that sound very much alike. Many of these names that I will mention in this episode begin with a J, usually Joe or Je. There's a reason for this. Israelites, like many others in the Near East, used theophoric names. That means that they embedded the name of their god, Yah, Jah, into their names to evoke divine protection. There are many theophoric names common today. Theodore, for example, means in Greek a gift of God. Christine is an obvious example of a theophoric name. My own name, Michael, in Hebrew, Michael, means one who is like God, an assertion vigorously denied by my family. In any case, theophoric names are interesting to the historian because they reflect the God to which those who gave the name were devoted. We will return to the issue of theophoric names at the end of this episode. I will try to remind you throughout to which J king I am referring. In the 7th and 6th centuries BCE, Judah was located right on the border of two great and mighty kingdoms. The Egyptians had already for many centuries been a power to be reckoned with, and one who regularly asserted its might in Judah. To the north, though, was the emerging superpower of Babylonia, whose forces crushed the Assyrians, the power that had earlier, in the 8th century, conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. Judah and the coastal plain along the Mediterranean was borderland, where Egyptian might met Babylonian ambition. King Josiah and his counselors were skilled at negotiating this treacherous geopolitical position. The biblical historian regards King Josiah as the last great and good Israelite king. He assumed office when he was 8 years old and ruled for 31 years in Jerusalem, from 640 BCE to 609. He appears to have thrown his lot in with the Babylonians. When the Egyptian forces moved north to aid the Assyrians in their doomed struggle against the Babylonians, Josiah is said to have confronted them at Megiddo. That was a stupid move. The Egyptian forces, of course, won, and Josiah was killed. For the biblical author, Josiah was best remembered as the king who rediscovered, with the help of the high priest Hilkiah, the scroll of the teaching. Probably, in the opinion of many scholars, this is the biblical book now known as Deuteronomy. Josiah began a series of reforms aimed at centralizing the cult at the Jerusalem temple. He built up and supported the temple. He destroyed the various images of other gods that appear to have been commonly located in the Jerusalem temple, and threw down the shrines that were scattered throughout his kingdom. One of his reforms in particular stands out. According to 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 21, Josiah commanded the people to offer the Passover sacrifice at the temple in Jerusalem. The next verse continues, "Now the Passover sacrifice had not been offered in that manner in the days of the chieftains who ruled Israel, or during the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. Only in the 18th year of King Josiah was such a Passover sacrifice offered in that manner to the Lord in Jerusalem." Josiah, as commanded in the book of Deuteronomy, tried to convert the local family custom of remembering the national salvation story into an institutionalized cultic holiday to take place in Jerusalem. Josiah's decision to ally with the Babylonians was not a smart short-term decision. On his death, his son, Jehoahaz, whom Josiah apparently fathered when he was 16, assumed his father's throne. His reign was brief. 3 months after becoming king, Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him, imposed a heavy tribute on Judah, and installed his own king. He chose another of the sons of Josiah, Eliakim, whom the Egyptians, peculiarly, gave the name Jehoiakim. It appears that Jehoiakim was 2 years older than Jehoahaz, but by a different wife. If so, Josiah would have fathered him when he was 14. Jehoiakim raised the tribute to give to the Egyptians, but it was not long before he had to switch sides. Only 5 years into his reign, in 604 or 603, as the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar were on the move, Jehoiakim became a vassal of the Babylonians. That lasted only 3 years, though, and even as the Babylonians were taking the upper hand in their struggle with Egypt, Jehoiakim aligned himself again with Egypt. While the Babylonians and their allies harassed him, they did not launch a full-scale effort against him until perhaps the very end of his reign. Jehoiakim died in 597 BCE under unknown circumstances, and he was succeeded by Jehoiachin, identified in 2 Chronicles as his son, who was himself only 8 years old when he assumed the throne. Only 3 months into Jehoiachin's reign, Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. Jehoiachin had no real hope, and he and his court surrendered quickly. Nebuchadnezzar's forces plundered the temple and sent Jehoiachin, his court, and several other elite families into exile in Babylonia. According to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 41, Jehozadak, the high priest and descendant of Aaron, was among these exiles. There is a discrepancy in our sources about the size of this deportation. According to 2 Kings 24:14, there were 10,000 deportees. Jeremiah chapter 52, verse 28, though, claims that only 3,023 were exiled. Among these exiled to Babylonia was the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel's prophecies are presented as visions of what was to happen in Jerusalem, even as he appears to have lived the rest of his life in Babylonia. Rather than focusing on the political and military events per se, Ezekiel's prophecies instead largely concern the punishments that will devolve on the nations that attacked Israel, as well as eschatological visions of the temple. The latter is particularly interesting. Ezekiel was also a priest, and we have to assume that he was familiar with the temple in Jerusalem before he was exiled. His descriptions of the temple do not match the descriptions that we have in other sources, though, and the purpose of these intricate plans, detailed by Ezekiel, is not clear. Let us leave Ezekiel in Babylonia with Jehoiachin for the moment and return to Judah. Having deposed Jehoiachin, Nebuchadnezzar naturally wanted a local ruler who would do his bidding as a vassal. He chose Jehoiachin's uncle, Mattaniah, whose name he changed to Zedekiah. He had the same mother as Jehoahaz, and was apparently a son of King Josiah. The royal descendants of David were split between supporters of Egypt and Babylonia. The book of Jeremiah reflects the rising international tensions. Jeremiah began his prophecies in the time of King Josiah in 627 BCE. Jeremiah's relationship with the recognized institutions seems always to have been a bit uneasy. Much of his prophecy consists of diatribes against false prophets, presumably those institutionalized prophets of the temple. This tension reached a boiling point under King Zedekiah. Although he owed his throne to Nebuchadnezzar, Zedekiah rebelled against him. This reflected critically poor judgment. Jeremiah had consistently supported the alliance with Babylonia, and even in the time of Jehoiakim, his prophecies were thought to cross the line to treason. Jeremiah was flogged, and Zedekiah had him imprisoned. Yet these pro-Babylonian prophecies undoubtedly ended up saving his life. In 589 BCE, Nebuchadnezzar moved against Jerusalem. The siege of Jerusalem lasted for 17 months. The Babylonians were content to starve them out rather than directly assaulting the city's walls. By the time the Babylonians moved against the walls, Jerusalem's inhabitants were starving. According to 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 3 to 4, the breach in the wall appears to have been made on the ninth day of the fourth month, that is, Tammuz, which normally occurs around June or July in our calendar. It is interesting to note here that according to Jewish tradition, the assault on Jerusalem began in the 17th rather than the ninth day of Tammuz. The reason for this discrepancy is unclear. Zedekiah and his court saw that all was lost, and they fled south. The Babylonians pursued and captured him near Jericho. They tried him before Nebuchadnezzar, slaughtered his sons in front of him, and then blinded him, so that would be the last thing he ever saw. They then put him in chains and brought him to Babylonia. Meanwhile, a few weeks later, on the 7th of Av, the Babylonians set fire to the temple. This is the event commemorated by the fast on the 9th of Av, known as Tisha B'Av. Another discrepancy. The leaders of the revolt left in Jerusalem were put to death. Several more elite families who submitted to Babylonian rule were exiled to Babylonia, another 832 people. The remaining treasures of the temple were taken to Babylonia as well. Jeremiah was spared by Nebuchadnezzar, and he stayed in Jerusalem under the patronage of Nebuchadnezzar's latest appointment as the ruler of Judah, a man named Gedaliah. Gedaliah did not last for long, maybe a few weeks, maybe a year, maybe 5 years. The biblical record is not entirely clear. According to the account in Jeremiah, another non-Israelite king, who had ambitions against Babylonian rule, sent an assassin. The assassin was himself from the Davidic line, though he might have had independent and personal reasons for wanting what he might have seen as his family's usurper killed. The assassin killed Gedaliah, but the coup was doomed, and everyone knew it. The counter-coup, led by Gedaliah's former military commanders, succeeded, but unsure of the ultimate Babylonian response, they fled with a large contingent to Egypt. Jeremiah, who advised against this, nevertheless went with them, not entirely willingly. Any pretense at Israelite self-autonomy had come to an end. One incident that occurred around this time deserves mention. Jeremiah chapter 41, verses 4 to 7, relates an incident that occurred 2 days after Gedaliah's murder, before it was publicly known. According to this account, 80 men came from Shechem, Shiloh, and Samaria, their beards shaved, their garments torn, and their bodies gashed, carrying meal offerings and frankincense to present at the house of the Lord. Most of them were promptly killed by Gedaliah's killers. What is interesting in this brief account is the reaction of these northerners to the destruction of the temple. For them, although destroyed, the temple was still very much on their minds. They were actively mourning it, even to the point of self-mutilation. Yet they were also going to make offerings, albeit non-animals, at the site of its ruins. The site of the temple was still very much irreplaceable holy space. It was still the portal to God. This, though, is not quite the end of our story. Remember Jehoiachin, the second king after Josiah, who at 8 years old ruled only for 3 months? We left him in exile years before in Babylonia. It has now been a few years since Gedaliah's assassination, and Nebuchadnezzar has himself died, leaving his kingdom to his son. In the 37th year of the exile of King Jehoiachin of Judah, the very end of 2 Kings tells us, on the 27th day of the 12th month, King Evil-Merodach of Babylon, in the year he became king, took note of King Jehoiachin of Judah and released him from prison. He spoke kindly to him and gave him a throne above those of other kings who were with him in Babylon. His prison garments were removed, and he received regular rations by his favor for the rest of his life. A regular allotment of food was given him by the insistence of the king, an allotment for each day, all the days of his life. 2 Kings then ends with a glimmer of hope. The tale that I have told here is one primarily of geopolitics. Two kings of Judah made incredibly bad judgments, leading ultimately to the destruction of the temple and the exile of Judah's elite. Jehoiakim's flip-flopping was most likely responsible for Nebuchadnezzar's first march against Jerusalem in 597 BCE, the brunt of which Jehoiachin would bear. Zedekiah was, well, an idiot for rebelling against Babylonia, and he and his nation paid the price for it. All of the information from which I have drawn this interpretation is in the Bible. But while the authors of these biblical accounts were not completely unaware or uninterested in geopolitical explanations, they had other things on their mind. Bad statecraft alone was not a sufficient explanation. These ancient authors felt compelled to explain not only the loss of political independence, but perhaps more importantly, the destruction of God's house and God's seeming abandonment of his people. The theological problem was acute. Remember that the temple was not just a place where God was worshipped. It was also the place that God dwelt. How can one explain the destruction of God's house? On the one hand, such a destruction might have occurred against God's will. This, however, creates a theological nightmare. It means that God lost, most likely to the power of other stronger gods. This is certainly how the Babylonians saw it. On the other hand, the destruction of God's house might be explained as a fulfillment of God's desire. The logical ramifications of this position were unpleasant, but not quite as severe. God no longer desired to dwell among his people. The biblical authors chose the second option. That said, there were different variations on this basic theme. The most common and least surprising of these variations was that God was directly punishing Israel for the sins of her people. The kings did badly in the eyes of the Lord is a common biblical refrain. Interestingly, the author of 2 Kings, who is usually not shy about detailing the sins of bad kings, is cryptic about what it is that these later kings actually did. For Jeremiah, the primary sin is neglect of the poor and the perversion of justice, a catch-all charge that is almost always applicable. Ezekiel's charge is more predictable and salacious. In chapter 23, Ezekiel tells a parable of sisters. They have similar sounding names, and they are meant to represent Samaria and Judah. Oholah, representing Samaria, was a slut. But Oholibah, or Judah, was worse. Having seen the acts of her sister, Oholibah's lusting was more depraved than her sister's, and her whoring more debased. She took lovers from among Assyrians and Babylonians, remembering fondly how she played the whore with the Egyptians, quote, whose members were like those of asses, and whose organs were like those of stallions. Ezekiel weaves together two themes in this analogy. The image of the whoring, which ultimately will be punished by Israel's lovers attacking her, is a condemnation of Israel's intercourse with the Babylonians and the Egyptians, an ultimately unfair charge given the necessity of such dealings. More so, though, the image of whoring evokes the worship of other gods. Israel will be punished, as Ezekiel continues in verse 30, for your harlotries with the nations, for defiling yourself with their fetishes. Israel, in this explanation, is punished for her whoring with other gods. One problem with this explanation, though, is that it doesn't exactly work. Remember that Nebuchadnezzar's first despoiling of the temple and deportation of Judahite leaders occurred during the reign of Jehoiachin, an 8-year-old. What could he have possibly done to have merited such divine punishment? The author of 2 Kings is aware of the problem, and several times asserts that punishment came on Israel for the sins of their ancestors. The prophetess Huldah, one, by the way, of only 4 prophetesses mentioned by name in the Hebrew Bible, tells King Josiah that Israel is doomed for its sins, although his own virtuous behavior will delay the inevitable. According to 2 Kings 23:26, the Lord did not turn away from his awesome wrath, which he blazed up against Judah because of all the things Manasseh did to vex him. The decree against Israel could not be averted. As I mentioned in the last episode, this explanation was known by and explicitly rejected by Ezekiel, who insisted that children would not be punished or rewarded for the acts of their parents. Yet another explanation for the disaster emerges incidentally. In Egypt, after the assassination of Gedaliah, Jeremiah continues to rebuke the people for their practices. In chapter 24, verses 17 to 18, they tell Jeremiah that they will not listen to him. On the contrary, they say, we will do everything that we have vowed, to make offerings to the Queen of Heaven, and to pour libations to her, as we used to, we and our fathers, our kings and our officials, in the town of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. For then we had plenty to eat, we were well off, and suffered no misfortune. But ever since we stopped making offerings to the Queen of Heaven, and pouring libations to her, we have lacked everything, and we have been consumed by the sword and famine. This rather heterodox explanation, which might well have been common, suggests that it was Josiah and his reforms that led to the temple's destruction. The Queen of Heaven, Ishtar or Asherah, also needed to be placated, and the neglect of her service led to the nation's calamities. This, needless to say, is an explanation that Jeremiah rejects. Whatever the explanations, the facts on the ground were the same. Jerusalem and the temple lay in ruins, and anywhere from 4,000 to 10,000 Judahite elites now lived in Babylonia. We do not know how many Judahites went to Egypt, but we have to assume that the bulk of the population remained in Jerusalem. We would like to know more about the Judahite community in Babylonia, for it will be out of this community that the builders of the Second Temple would come, and which, it seems, produced the Torah. Unfortunately, the historical record is sparse. It is plausible to think that the adult Jehoiachin, the descendant of David, who now has the favor and recognition of the king of Babylonia, assumed some kind of leadership role in this community, whether in actuality or simply symbolically. Indeed, it is to the community of these first deportees in Babylonia that Jeremiah earlier sent a letter in which God instructs these exiles, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their fruit, take wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease, and seek the welfare of the city to which I have exiled you, and pray to the Lord in its behalf, for in its prosperity you shall prosper. Jeremiah advises the exiles to make a home and get comfortable in Babylonia. They are not coming back. I don't know if they needed Jeremiah's advice, but this appears to be exactly what they did. The evidence for this is a chance archaeological discovery. Among the many cuneiform tablets unearthed to date was a cache in Nippur of about 730 tablets, records of a 5th century banking family known as the Murashu. Within these documents, there are about 70 names that we can identify with those of Israelite descent. The documents are themselves unremarkable, and the transactions entered into by these individuals do not differ at all from those of anybody else. At least in the very limited perspective reflected in these tablets, that of banking and commerce, these Israelites were doing well and fully integrated into their larger community. But if these individuals look like everybody else, how do we know that they were Israelite? Well, remember theophoric names, personal names that integrate the God's name. A number of these names incorporate the element Yah, Jah, the name of the God of the Israelites, found also in the names of the kings of Israel. Just as interesting, though, is the fact that many of the relatives of these individuals do not have such Yahwistic names. There may, in fact, have been a chronological pattern in which Yahwistic names gave way to more neutral or even Babylonian names, only to return to names that incorporate a different name of the Israelite god, El. This is an interesting choice because the element El also has a Babylonian resonance. It would thus allow for names that signal devotion to the God of Israel while not sounding too weird among a more general public. The Israelites found in the Murashu archive were living in the historic land of Babylonia, entering into contracts written in Akkadian, but their rulers were no longer Babylonians. Babylonia's time had come. She was conquered by Persia in 539 BCE. It was the Persians who supported the return to Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the Second Temple, and that is the topic that will be taken up in the next episode. You have been listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew by Michael Sadlow. You can find more information about the podcast www.mlsadlow.com on the blog and public education pages. I welcome your comments. The original music is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tattenbaum. Thank you for listening.